A Fort Lauderdale City Commissioner decides to work among the homeless in order to better serve them. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
Just sitting next to someone who's homeless helps inform and instruct me as to what solutions we need to be implementing, and also getting the folks that are here in the encampment, they're buying.
We'll talk with Commissioner Ben Sorensen, who moved his air-conditioned office to a tent in a homeless encampment looking for solutions. Plus, Florida's cutting arts funding by the tens of millions. Will nonprofits across our region be able to survive? How are they creatively fundraising to keep themselves afloat? And a new photo exhibit is coming to South Beach. It's not in a gallery or museum, but it's going to be shown on an LED screen floating in the water. You can catch it this Saturday as part of Urban Beach Week. We'll talk with a photographer. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Arts nonprofits across Florida are facing a steep fundraising challenge. Grant money for the arts has been slashed year after year, and the newest budget will be the biggest cut yet, a 90% decrease of $22 million on the chopping block. How are nonprofits in South Florida raising the money they need to continue operating? Jay Abade is the CEO of ArtServe, a nonprofit arts incubator that supports artists and cultural organizations in Broward County. Jay, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Also joining us from WXEL in Palm Beach County is Beth Clark, CEO of Young Singers of the Palm Beaches. Clark visited Tallahassee in January as part of a campaign for gathering grants funding for the arts. And we should also note that we reached out to the State Division of Cultural Affairs to participate in the conversation. They were unavailable to join. But Beth, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you.
All right. So I want to hear from both of you. I mean, did you see these kind of cuts coming? Because we know year to year over the last few years, that number's been dwindling down. But this was a big, big cut this time. Jay, let me start with you. I mean, did you expect this, or did you think anything like this could happen?
Well, I definitely expected a cut. That's been the pattern that we've seen. And so I budgeted for that. I know many of the other organizations in Broward that I've spoken with had anticipated a cut. We did not see them basically defunding an entire industry for the entire state. So the volume of the cut was really just put us in a shock and awe.
When you saw that final number, at that moment, what's going on and what's in your mind?
Well, I sort of took a deep breath, called a few friends in the arts to grieve. And then really, I just kind of pulled myself together and said, I'm going to convene a group of all the Broward organizations that are impacted and get us together and say, how do we move forward? We're going to get through this, and we'll get through it stronger together.
And Beth, what about you? I mean, you see this kind of cut. What were you thinking, and how's this impacting you?
Well, I always hope that they do not cut. Several years ago, 3 years ago, we were fully funded. Since that time, it's gone down yearly. But this year to come in at such a low amount was shocking. And I think disgusting, to be honest with you. I think we are an industry, as Jay said, and we need to be accounted for and respected as an industry. And this is the one grant we can get for general operating support. And general operating support means we can turn on the lights. We can pay our staff. And this is an incredibly important grant for everyone to receive so they can simply do business in the state of Florida.
You know, does anybody here know why this happened? I mean, it's political, but I mean, why the big, big cut? What are some of the things that you've heard, Jay?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not a mind reader. I wish I was. I think that it's just sort of the tone of the season. I think also a lot of the state is rural, and there is about four main counties that have more cultural activities than the others. So maybe it's just not a priority. I don't really know. I was not in Tallahassee, although I was watching the budget process very, very closely so that we could sort of be prepared moving forward. And, you know, I would say also that the state budget goes into effect next week, June 1st, most of the cultural organizations in Broward and many throughout the state start their fiscal year October 1. So they're really seeing their funding just go off the rails next week.
And Beth, you did go to Tallahassee. You're part of that campaign. Did you talk to lawmakers afterwards? Did they tell you why?
I was not – well, the issue that came out was because of the horrific shootings in Parkland, and that money had been taken away from several of us to fund the gun control and the security issue around that.
And they also said the hurricane.
Right. But however, I was up there in January, the first day of the Senate meeting, the committee meeting, and it came in at a low amount on that day, to be honest with you. And so I don't believe that that's actually true. I think they never really intended to fund us.
What was that writing campaign, that letter writing campaign that you engaged in with families?
Yes, because this is so important to us. My families all wrote letters. We had over 2,000 letters go to the committees that were meeting regarding the funding, the committee members that were regarding the funding, and the leadership in the Senate and the House. And not only were letters written in support of the Division of Cultural Affairs, the full funding, but it also went to the governor. We had calls. We had emails from board members, patrons. So just my organization, the over 2,000, and it's important to remember, I'm just one of 400 and I think it's 90, something like that, organizations across the state.
And by the way, these families, who are these groups that were working with you?
Well, I have a large organization. We are the Palm Beach County's Children and Youth Community Choir. So 350 families in my core group, and then I have about 900 students in after-school programs. But we also had patrons come to us. They had heard that this was that there was concern, and so they wrote letters for us. So it was patrons, family members, and my board and staff.
So, Jay, coming back to you, I mean, how much do you lose in Broward County? How much do the different groups lose? You know, what happens next?
Well, the actual number that we're losing, it's about 30-something, 30-odd groups are losing $603,448, to be exact, this year, just to keep on pace with last year's funding, which was already down about 29%. So, you know, everybody is really trying to do more with less because, you know, we are a county that's growing. And so there's more demand, more need. If you're running a historical center, if you're running a museum, if you're running programs that do work in Title I schools for the neediest in our community, as some of these youth arts organizations do, the demand is up and, you know, is rising.
Do you see places where programs may disappear or you're just not going to be able to help?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things we did, you know, after we got the actual staggering numbers of the cuts, we convened this meeting. We had about 100% participation in from all of the groups. And we, you know, I said, bring with us the impacts that these cuts are going to have with you. And, you know, almost to a one, you know, many were saying that they couldn't cut staff because they already, you know, really operate on a very, very, you know, tight budgets and don't overstaff. But some definitely said jobs were going to be lost. I know one youth organization, the Florida Youth Orchestra's Music, said they might have to cut 10 people. They're definitely going to have to cut programs that they serve schools like the Title I schools. Many organizations said they might have to cut programs where they do art therapy with veterans. You know, really important programs where people may not associate it with art exactly.
And so, I mean, this is devastating. There are going to be
very
a lot of big changes coming. Beth, the Young Singers of Palm Beach County got $64,000 from the state 3 years ago.
Right.
And my understanding is now you're just getting $6,000.
$6,000. And so for me, of course, this is a huge decrease in funding. And so we are not going to cut programming. We made a decision as a board and staff to not, but we're going to have to do a lot more with less staff. I mean, that's just how we have to do it. Not that I'm going to be laying anyone off, but I can't hire people, temporaries, to help us out in the office. Also, I will be looking at all our concerts to make sure that that we are budgeting those appropriately. And so we may have a loss of some musicians. We could look at lighting. You know, there are a lot of things that we will have to look at doing without. The thing with budgeting is you either make more money or you go out with less. And so while we have made a decision to not cut programming, we will have to. The stress on staff is huge, and we're going to have to do a lot more.
Again, we're talking about arts funding and really the fact that there's not going to be that much this year because the Florida legislature made some massive cuts to arts funding for this upcoming budget, which starts again in a month. 90% decrease. And so how are nonprofits across South Florida going to go forward? Well, we've already heard from a couple of folks that there could be cuts. There could be cuts to programs, cuts to jobs. Talking with Jay Abate, the CEO of ArtServe, again, a nonprofit arts incubator that supports artists and cultural organizations in Broward County. And also joining us from WXEL in Palm Beach County is Beth Clark, CEO of Young Singers of the Palm Beaches. You can find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, or on Twitter. Again, our handle is at WLRN Sundial. We'd like to hear from you if, you know, you expected some of this money. And now that it's not going to be there, or a lot less is going to be there, what do you foresee happening to your program? What are you concerned about moving forward into the next fiscal year? Again, find us on WLRN Sundial on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you. So if you don't have that money coming in from the state, then obviously, like any other nonprofit, any organization, you have to go find that money somewhere. Jay, let me start with you. I mean, there's already fundraising in the nonprofit sector anyway, but what changes now? I mean, is it just, well, go knock on some more doors, find some more ways to get money, find some donors who are willing to help out some?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what everybody is out there doing. You know, we got the information. It was in March. You know, that's March Madness in the arts world in South Florida as well. Everybody's in the heart of their seasons. Still, so, you know, people made pitches to donors, you know, at their events. Everybody's trying to, we're a creative industry, so we're going to get creative about fundraising. But also in Broward, we sort of, you know, when we hunkered together, we said, let's work together to maybe do a PR and awareness campaign and try to raise funds from the public so that we can try to fill the gap in the funding process. And so I'm hoping to launch that possibly in June when the funding kind of falls off the cliff for all the organizations.
You know, Beth, I'd read that, mm-hmm. you know, there are groups that kind of just depended on that money and maybe they didn't put as much time and effort into that fundraising. Now, well, they're kind of forced to. But I just want to know from you thoughts on how creative do you have to be to make up for that? 64,000 a few years ago, you're down to six.
Right. Well, I think it's a short-term and long-term approach. There are some things short-term that we have to do. That is looking at your budget very closely, and the boards are all stepping up to the plate, and I know helping many organizations with finding additional funds through contacts that they have, events, things like that. But we also have to look at this long term. I believe it is a creative industry. The Division of Cultural Affairs is a wonderful terminology, but the reality is we're an industry that brings in quite a bit of money to the state of Florida. And in fact, I think arts funding research has shown that we bring in $9 for every dollar that's given to us through the state funding. So I think there needs to be a perception change that we absolutely need this money. This money is helping the economy all throughout the state of Florida, not just in the cultural affairs, but we're putting helping restaurants because people come, they buy tickets to events and they go out to dinner. They go shopping. There are many ways that the cultural arts funding is important to the whole economy.
So you talk about this $9 for every dollar that's spent on arts, but okay, so that, I mean, you know, basic math, that sounds like a good return, but obviously lawmakers weren't convinced.
Right. I think it's seen as a soft industry, not something that they can see hard dollars in. And also, I have to be honest, I think it has to do with perhaps lobbying, having a better lobbying effort.
That costs
because
money.
If you think it costs money, but it costs money. And that's hard for not-for-profits to spend because we are focusing on the people we are serving in our mission.
You also have tried, you know, so talking about creative ways of raising money, you've tried something once called Adopt a Song.
Yes. For our concerts, we, of course, we have many choirs singing many songs. And so we put it out there that if you would like to adopt a song, your name will be in the program for a certain amount of money. And you can put a nice sentiment in. You could make it in memory of someone. And so that has been successful for us. We also look to other children's choirs across the nation to look at their fundraising strategies and have adopted some of those.
Jay, is there any exploration of perhaps going local, looking at local governments to help foot some of the bill, also possibly even local taxation to help in the funding?
Well, that's definitely part of the conversation. You know, we did meet with the Cultural Division. Everybody is sort of, you know, working together to try to see what the next steps are. I think, you know, that a big issue is just awareness and in the public of how important this industry is to the economy. I mean, you know, this is a group that creates a tremendous amount of value in the economy. I mean, actually, arts and culture, I believe, generates more revenue statewide than retail, than agriculture, than, you know, many, many other industries. And so, you know, I think it is a perception shift that needs to happen. We need to try some different approaches about how we spread the word and how we make sure that people out in the public realize the impact both on the economy and both on the quality of life that these cuts are going to have.
And look, as big as the cuts were, let me ask you this, both of you. Could there be a benefit in disentangling yourself from state financing? Do these grants ever come with burdening strings attached? Maybe this is a good thing, Jay.
I would say that the amount of revenue that every organization gets from the state is not significant in terms of, you know, their day-to-day operations of in the long term. In the short term, do I think it's going to force us to get more creative? I think that, you know, we've already been in this pattern of, you know, year after year trying to get more creative and trying to keep programs going and expand. But again, as I said, you know, we're in a state where, you know, we're expanding, we're growing. We have increased demand on our facilities, increased demand for programs. And so I think the state also, it's a quality of life issue. People need to support these you know, organizations and the venues that they operate, where everybody wants to come. That's why people are coming here. That's why they're moving here.
Beth, I wanted your take on that as well. Again, just trying to see if there's a silver lining in this.
I don't know that there's a silver lining. I think the good news is that there's a lot of awareness now about the issue of funding for the arts. And I think that's really important. I think there should be this issue should be in the paper often, because it is something that people should be aware of, because it's really a voting issue. Are you voting for legislators that support the things that you think are important? And I think if the arts are important for you, find out which legislators support the arts. Go to town hall meetings. I see it as part of the political process that's very important, and certainly for the young people that are getting ready to vote.
Do either of you think that this is, because Jay had mentioned a second ago, there's a little bit of politics in this, and it's an up and down kind of roller coaster ride. Is it just a matter of saying, well, let's wait after the election? You'll have a different governor. You may have some. You're going to have some different legislators, different legislature. Maybe they'll change their thinking in the next session. Is it just a matter of waiting for that?
Well, I don't think any of us are in a waiting pattern. I think that at one time the line item for art and culture in the state was a guaranteed amount that could go up if need arose, or, you know, as we said, you know, we have increased people moving to the state and increased need and demand. But that said, I think that we're not at all in a wait and see mode, because what's going to happen is if you don't have the money to improve your facilities and they start deteriorating, even if you do get funding down the road, your cost is going to be that much more, because you are going to, you know, have to mitigate, you know, the damage.
Beth, because you mentioned finding lawmakers who support the arts. You know, the arts is not usually a topic that's high on the list for voters when they're going to the ballot box. It's taxes, mm-hmm. it's jobs, it's a lot of other things. So how do you get people to talk about or think about the arts funding? And again, it's a very, even when it was at its fullest, it's a very, very small part of the budget.
Right.
So
right.
How do you get voters to push that issue?
I think it's important for the voters to understand what happens when it doesn't come in, the things that will be cut, the jobs that will be cut, and that it is an industry that should have support from, I think, from the county and the state. Because, as Jay said, it's a quality of life issue. Every week I get a call from someone, a potential person who's thinking of moving to Florida, South Florida, and saying, tell me about your program because I have a child, and I would like to know what kind of programs you have for my child. So that tells me right there that if I get a call every week from somebody questioning that, other arts organizations are too. And that's important to people that are going to be coming in as taxpaying citizens. They'll have jobs, they'll own homes, they'll be purchasing items here in South Florida. So I think it's really important to remember that we are just part of the whole process of the economic health of the state.
And again, we're talking about cuts to arts in Florida because this past legislative session, there were massive cuts to the budget for grants for arts programs. We've been talking with Jay Abate, the CEO of the Nonprofit Arts Incubator in Broward County ArtServe, also talking with Beth Clark, CEO of Young Singers of the Palm Beaches. She spoke to us from WXEL in Palm Beach County. Jay, Beth, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And just to mention, if you work with an arts nonprofit in Miami or elsewhere in South Florida, we want to hear from you. How are you dealing with the cuts in grant funding? Tweet us or post us on our Facebook page. Just look up WLRN Sundial. This will be an ongoing conversation as we move forward into the summer. Well, still to come, we're going to talk with a Fort Lauderdale commissioner who wants to solve homeless issues. So now he runs his office out of a homeless camp. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Homelessness remains a critical problem in communities across South Florida, from providing needed services to help people deal with mental health challenges to reducing substance abuse. There's a lot of work to do. And there remains a lack of affordable housing in the state. All of these issues have become politically divisive. In Fort Lauderdale, a city that has experienced national ridicule and scrutiny over how it's dealt with homeless, leaders are trying to find a more humane way of helping this portion of the population. Vice Mayor and City Commissioner Ben Sorensen recently decided to move from one of his offices to a homeless encampment. It's located at the main library in downtown. He works out of a tent, holding all of his meetings under the elements, forcing the community to look at the issue up close. And we spoke to him recently via Skype from the encampment, and I started by asking him, why'd you want to do this?
So homelessness has long been a concern of mine. It's something I've been working on for years. About 6 years ago, I co-founded something called Mission United of the United Way of Broward County. And this has been an effort to help our veterans that are homeless find homes, find lodging. And we've helped house over 800 veterans. We've helped veterans get jobs. We've helped veterans get legal service. And it has been a fantastic success. And we still have the broader homeless population in Broward County, we still have about 2,300 folks who are homeless. And so we need to help serve those homeless folks. And so I moved down here to the encampment so that, one, it's top of mind for me every day when I come to my satellite office here. Two, so that everyone who meets with me, whether they're meeting with me about sewers or about development projects, that they see what we're facing as a community and helping me come up with solutions. And so right now, as I'm speaking, we have United Way caseworkers that are helping to get some folks housing. And so that's part of why I'm here to address these concerns.
Have you asked any of the other commissioners or the mayor to join you?
You know what? I haven't. They're aware that I'm here. And so, you know, if they'd like to join me at any point, I'd obviously welcome them to come down. And I have found, obviously, I've been talking with the other commissioners and the mayor about homelessness. And we've really, as a commission, really started to come up with some good ideas and some real proactive steps. So I'm So I'm really excited about the collaboration we're already finding within the commission to address this.
Now, you know, Fort Lauderdale has been scrutinized nationally over the way it's dealt with the homeless population. There was the bulldozers at Stranahan Park. There was the ongoing battle with Arnold Abbott, the 90-year-old man who was feeding the homeless, who was getting arrested. I mean, what does the city have to do to change that reputation?
So I think we've already started to go down a little bit of a different path. And what we need to do is, it's not about working against a population or against a group of people. It's about working with them and bringing in stakeholders in the community to help solve this problem. So right now in Fort Lauderdale and Broward County, we have the business community has been being very engaged recently and looking at solutions. And so that's a huge win. The city is engaging with Broward County. I've met with the county administrator the other day, and I'm having good conversations with Broward County commissioners about how we can work together. So we aren't going to ordinance our way out of this problem. It's about finding affordable housing, finding supportive services, and finding a place these folks can go during the day to get out of the park. And I think we're heading in the right direction.
So, Commissioner, what has your time at the camp been like? I mean, how do you describe what it's like to live there? And you're going home at night, but I'm saying, you know, being there during the day and, you know, trying to work out of the space that you're in. What's it been like?
One, it's very educational for me. And, I've spent a lot of my many years recently on homelessness, but there's nothing like sitting down and talking to folks. I was just sitting next to someone who's homeless. Her name's Angel, and she's had a tough time getting work and finding housing, and hearing what her income is, what her challenges have been, why she left her previous housing that she had, helps inform and instruct me as to what solutions we need to be implementing. And also getting the folks that are here in the encampment, they're buying, saying, hey, if we're able to offer you this service or this housing option, is that something you'd be interested in? Because we can come up with all kinds of solutions, but if there aren't solutions that these folks are interested in partaking in, we're spinning our wheels.
And you, as you said, you are having meetings. I mean, meetings you would usually have in your air-conditioned office with people from around the city. What have they told you about what it's like to work with you and talk with you in that sort of environment?
Well, it's been really fantastic. And I tell you, even if we're not, our a meeting with someone is not focused on homelessness, inevitably it comes up. And the compassion that folks have when they meet with me is amazing. I've had, you know, business leaders and service providers say to me, hey, what else could we be doing to help? How can we get on board and support what the city's doing? And so we immediately lead into a brainstorming and action planning. And that's part of what I'm so excited about is people want to do something. They oftentimes just don't know what to do. And so by doing some of this, I think we're starting to get more of an action plan going.
And you meet with the folks who actually do live there, some of the homeless living there. You talked about someone named Angel. Early on, you talked to a gentleman named Jesse Benner that I had read about. I mean, when you talk with these folks, what are they telling you? How did they end up there? What's their situation? What's their story?
There's a couple that lives here, a man and a woman, and they were in housing. Their rent was increased. And so they couldn't sustain it. And so now they're here and they're working. There's a misunderstanding that these folks don't have jobs. A lot of these folks are working, but they're not earning wages that are high enough to provide for living in Broward County. And here in Broward County, we have one of the highest costs of living. When you look at cost of living versus average income here, it's one of the highest in the country. So these folks are at school, they're working, and they need a place that can be affordable to them, and they're interested in finding a place. And so I think that's where this idea of affordable housing is one of the solutions to start helping them get on their feet and get going so that they can be in a place where they can feel secure at night and leave their possessions to go to work or to go to school.
I'm talking with Fort Lauderdale's Vice Mayor and Commissioner Ben Sorensen. He recently moved out of his office to work in a homeless encampment. This is the one near the main library downtown Fort Lauderdale. He joined us via Skype from the encampment, and he's sharing stories about the people he's meeting, but also trying to bring awareness to this issue. We all know about the issue of homelessness in the city of Fort Lauderdale. So, Commissioner, you talk about some of these solutions, but what more can the city, the county, what more can we do to help these folks find a better option?
So I think one of the things that's incumbent upon cities and counties is to, when there are development projects, to ensure that portions of those projects, of those apartments, are tagged for affordable housing, that there's a number of units that these folks can utilize that are available to them. So I think that's one. I think next piece is finding short-term shelter for these individuals. So we're really looking at that as a city and saying, okay, what are some areas where we might be able to relocate some of these folks, give them a place to store their possessions, to be in a building, to have air conditioning? And then the third is having wraparound services. So we've got to have service providers, as we are having right now. I'm looking at my tent, which is my office, and there's a United Way caseworker there that's in processing several of these folks that are living here and helping them find the services they need and the housing we need. And so the more we can have service providers continuing to team up in that manner, the more successful we're going to be.
The devastation of the opioid crisis has been well documented in South Florida. To what extent can drug rehabilitation and intervention help in reducing homelessness?
It's a very important part of it. And, you know, a lot of times these folks can spiral down, just as anyone, me, you, anyone can spiral down. So the more preventative kind of we can be in helping these folks get the housing they need, get jobs they need, it lessens the likelihood of addiction rearing its really ugly head. So it's another reason why I think early prevention, a few dollars metaphorically early on, saves some significant dollars and life costs down the road.
I wanted to ask you about the nonprofit task force. What role is it playing? What is it doing to help solve the problem?
Yeah, so the task force headed up by Lorraine Willoughby, is that the task force?
Yes.
Yeah, so they do amazing work. So they're here regularly helping to identify the needs of folks, helping them find housing solutions. So they're just one of the many groups that are really proactive and on the ground here.
There was a Sun Sentinel report that said there are roughly 300 homeless in the Fort Lauderdale community that continuously refuse services. How do you support a population that doesn't want your help?
Yeah, so I think that's a big challenge. And I'll tell you that when I'm here walking and talking to folks in the tents and they're coming up to my tent and talking with me, I have yet to interact with folks that say, I don't want any help. I don't want affordable housing. I don't want supportive services. You know, the folks that I'm talking to are very interested and very eager for a hand up. And I think that's what's key here is, you know, while handouts might feel good in the moment, we've got to provide more deeper systemic solutions.
Is there a community anywhere in the country that you could say, you can point to and say, they've achieved amazing success in helping the homeless population, that we could possibly emulate that?
Yeah, there are some great examples of that. Utah has done a phenomenal job in dramatically reducing its homeless population. Orlando has a great model that's been working very well. And what you see is common among all these cities and states that do this really well is the collaboration piece. As we're working together, we're sharing ideas, we are willing to let down our turf issues and find solutions. And, you know, just one example of that is Broward County has what's called the Continuum of Care Board, which is a great bringing together of service providers to work together. So the collaboration and also the urgency. I'm not a very patient person. And I think we've really got to create greater urgency around finding solutions as soon as possible, because one of my fears is that something bad would happen here at the downtown encampment. And I don't want, obviously, anything bad to happen. And so that, to me, every day is something, a reason why I want to get these folks into a better situation.
You know, we come back to the issue of affordable housing. And do you have any sort of plan, whether it's a tax plan or any kind of policy that can really lead and push toward creating more opportunities like that?
Fort Lauderdale City Commission has really made affordable housing a top priority. And so as we interact with folks who are developing and building here, having that discussion early on in the process of saying, hey, here's what the challenge we're facing, and when you look at the allocation of units, how much are you willing to help us achieve this? And then, and additionally, we have some very exciting partners that are coming forward and saying, hey, even from private dollars, foundation dollars, hey, we're interested in building affordable housing in Fort Lauderdale. So we're starting to see a lot more of this movement coming down the pipe.
How long are you going to stay out there?
You know, I don't know. But I feel the need to really stay out here until I feel like we've got a really good direction on this, that we have a really good plan in action, and that we're really moving these folks into a better condition. And if that takes a long time, then I'm willing to stay here to help support getting that solution going.
Talking with Fort Lauderdale Vice Mayor and Commissioner Ben Sorensen, he recently moved from his office to a makeshift office in a homeless encampment in downtown Fort Lauderdale to, again, bring awareness to the issue of homelessness, but also to see what else he could do from that perspective. He joined us via Skype from the encampment. Commissioner Sorensen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And you can find photos on our Facebook and Twitter of Commissioner Sorensen's office setup in the homeless encampment. You can find us again, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, a photo exhibit you can experience from the beach as part of Urban Beach Week. We'll talk with the artist who's behind the Black Florida Project. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the holiday weekend is upon us. It's Memorial Day weekend. And for South Beach, it's also Urban Beach Week, along with droves of visitors, music, plenty of festivities. There's something else to see this weekend, a floating photography exhibit. It's called Water Rights, an Act of Resistance by South Florida-based documentary photographer Johan Rahman. Rahman is best known for her project called Black Florida, an ongoing photographic documentation that reinterprets marginalized communities throughout Florida by visual storytelling. Now, the exhibit includes photographs and videos that Rahman has documented during Urban Beach Weeks from 2014 to 2016, and, of course, other photos at beaches and lakes all across Florida. Now, the photographs are going to be displayed on a giant LED screen and is going to travel on top of a floating barge from South Point to 25th Street. So joining me now in studio is Johan. Johan, welcome. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. So tell us about, I want to start with this, understanding this project. I wanted to understand your take on the narrative of water in the Black community, because this is a big story for you.
Well, Black community has this historical relationship with water. We were brought here by water. We, throughout segregation, we've been separated from being able to use spaces like swimming pools and beaches. And you have, in our modern time, we're still having this problem in places like South Beach, where it becomes a militarized zone when the Black community comes in for Memorial Day weekend festivities. So, and, you know, you have these images of a young girl being arrested and wrestled to the ground by a police officer in a swimsuit at a pool party. So we still have these images and these narratives of the Black community struggling for the right to just do something as simple as go to the beach, hang out at the pool.
And your project, I mean, your approach to this is not about those kind of images. It is actually something very festive. Looking through your work, it's about, it's very jovial. It's people enjoying themselves. You had a very different approach to this. I mean, why did you want to take that approach?
Because Urban Beach Week is maligned, and there's a different story. If you are there and you're a part of the event, you have a completely different experience from what is portrayed in mainstream media. And so I wanted to show that. And the way I look at the Black community is with love and with compassion. So that is reflected in the images.
And, you know, you talk about this long, because going back to your first answer, you talk about this long history of this relationship between the Black community and water, but also the battles that the Black community has had to the access to water. It's interesting you talk about, you know, here in Florida. I mean, we've done this on the program before. I mean, there was once a time when African-Americans, anybody of color, couldn't go to South Beach. You couldn't. There was a different beach for them.
Yes, yes. Virginia Key Beach was the Black beach. Access to it was by boat, and it was really swampy and kind of treacherous to get there. And that's changed. Now it's no longer a Black beach. It's known as a historical Black beach, but at the same time, the journey into Virginia Key Beach now is by toll. We're constantly dealing with these struggles with being able to access water. And yeah, it's, even though it's not segregated anymore, we still have an air of segregation around water that exists.
I find it interesting. As you said, there is a perception. It comes from the community, from the media, about Urban Beach Week. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, what that perception is. And again, it goes back to your project, because what you portray in your photographs goes against that perception. But what is that perception that you're talking about?
The perception is that it's dangerous to come to South Beach, to be on South Beach during Urban Beach Week, that it's not a welcoming place, which it's not for Black people. It's not welcoming to the people, the Black tourists coming in for the weekend. But it's definitely, it's something that we've grown used to. We've adapted to suit it, and we wear blinders and pretend it's not existing. And sometimes you can't pretend, but the fact is, it's a reality for, you know. I was talking to someone yesterday who, black people are told don't come to the beach because you could get arrested, and white people say don't come to the beach because it's just dangerous, it's not fun, it's crowded, you know,
during Urban Beach
Week.
Yes. Your project is called An Act of Resistance. Mm-hmm. And again, as I mentioned, going through the photographs, I see a lot of happiness and dancing, people basically standing with this pride, because one of the other things too is this resistance to body shaming. People are proud of what they are, don't hide anything at all. But I wanted to get your take on this. What you're portraying, is that an act of resistance to segregation that you want to show through your photographs? Again, this perception, what is the resistance here?
The resistance is against, it's against the narrative of Blackness being less than. We're resisting the walls, the invisible barriers that prevent us from coming to the ocean. You know, just being Black is an act of resistance.
Again, I'm talking with photographer Johan Rahman, and her work, Water Rights, An Act of Resistance, is going to come to South Beach this weekend for Urban Beach Week. And it's not in a studio or a gallery or museum. This is a series of photographs that will be displayed on a giant LED screen, and it's traveling on top of a floating barge, and it's coming from South Point to 25th Street. So this is the way that you're going to experience this work. We talk about Urban Beach Week, and for anybody who's been here at least the last couple of years, they know the infamous shooting in Miami Beach that happened Memorial Day 2011, Raymond Harris was shot and killed by police officers. Considering this story captured so much of the media's attention and the presence of law enforcement remains a big part of the weekend, did you ever want to tackle that issue in the stories? Because I didn't see any of that.
No, I don't. That is something, you know, there's trauma in the Black communities, and there's enough of that being addressed in the media. I don't need to do that. My focus is on the joy.
You got very close to a lot of people. When you look at the photographs, these are up close and personal photographs. Do you have to build a relationship with people? How do you approach them and tell them who you are and what you're doing and what do you want? And you're not asking them to pose so much. You want to capture them. But how does that work?
Well, for the images created during Urban Beach Weekend, those are street, they're street images. So there's very little, the project itself is a slow project. It takes me a while to get to know people and to build relationships with them. And I continue this over a period of time.
Take me to a moment when you do. Like you walk up, you see someone and you know right away from your eye that I want to talk to this person. How do you do it?
Well, the camera itself is the conversation piece. So if someone sees me with a camera, they know exactly why I'm there and what I'm going to do. And so that kind of opens the conversation with them. And usually it becomes their idea for me to photograph them.
And do you explain to them what you're working on and what you
yes.
want to capture? And what do you hear people say?
It's received with much passion in the community.
Was there one photograph, one person, one moment from your collection that stands out for you? I know that's a tough question.
The one that stands out was created in Fort Pierce, Mary Everett. I got to know her over a six-month period, and I grew very close to her, even though we spoke very few words. But she reminded me of my mom in many ways. She was really quiet, and I spent time just sitting with her. Sometimes I'd drive to Fort Pierce, which is about 2 hours away, and sit with her on her porch. And from the period of April when I met her to when she was buried in September, I grew very close to her. So whenever I go through the images and I see her photograph, it always, you know, it brings something back. It takes me back to the time sitting on her front porch.
Just describe that photograph too, by the way.
She is an extremely elegant woman in her 90s, gray hair. She wears rollers sometimes, and in some of the photographs she's wearing rollers, tangerine blouse, and a patterned skirt, legs crossed, arms crossed, and just really soft smile, beautiful, envious skin. And yeah, she's pure elegance, even with rollers.
Women are. The presentation, as I mentioned, it's not going to be in a gallery. You're not walking into a room and moving from photograph to photograph. This is on these big, it's going to be on a big LED screen on this watercraft. First of all, describe what people are going to see. What is that going to be like?
You'll see images from Urban Beach Weekend from 2014 to 2016. You'll also see images from a pool that was once segregated in Jacksonville, a swim meet at that pool, images from a ceremony, a religious ceremony on Virginia Key Beach for Juneteenth of 2015.
And so these images are just moving through
yes.
this big screen
yes.
as this watercraft is coming through.
Yes.
There, by the way, just there's rain in the forecast. Does that change anything? Yes.
Well, unfortunately, you know, we have to respect nature. So if the weather is not permitting the show to continue on to happen on Saturday, then we'll have to move it to Sunday. And if Sunday it's the same thing, then to Monday. But I encourage people to just stay in touch with the project on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter to get updates.
So it, just real quickly as we finish up, is what do you want people to take away from these images? What do you want them to experience?
For the outsider, I'd want them to, as I always say, to suspend judgment. The images should encourage you to suspend judgment. See an event in a way that you haven't thought about it before. For the locals also to take a chance and stay local and attend Urban Beach Week, for the city of Miami Beach to not get rid of the event, not take it indoors. It's a block party. They just had a big block party in Oakland to celebrate, you know, a really uncomfortable interaction with someone.
Between police and,
yes,
and the black community.
So,
again, the project is called Water Rights and Active Resistance, again, by South Florida-based documentary photographer Johan Rahman. And weather permitting, it is going to be on Saturday. And again, this is, it's on a, it's going to be photographs on an LED screen coming through on a water craft from South Point to 25th Street. Johan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you next week.